Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. There's no more enjoyable or popular source of historical information than historical fiction. But as the phrase implies, it is fiction. So just how much can we trust the authors of such literature to convey to us an accurate understanding of the past? In a moment, we'll pursue that subject with Kevin Baker, author of Dreamland, an historical novel. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. This week on July 14, 1789, angry Parisians stormed the Bastille, a medieval fortress that served as a prison, signaling the start of the French Revolution. The Bastille had come to be a symbol of the despotism of the French monarchy against which the French people revolted, sending both King Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette to the guillotine. Bastille Day, a national holiday in France, is celebrated annually on July 14th. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, contrary to popular belief, official U.S. documents say that while the Bush administration was outraged at China's military action at Tiananmen Square, the president regarded the incident as a Chinese internal affair. A memo delivered by National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger to China less than 4 weeks after the incident somewhat softened the immediate outrage voiced publicly by the U.S. government. The top-secret document went on to state that while the U.S. desired good foreign relations with China in the future, it needed an immediate end to the violent treatment of demonstrators. And the universe might not be as ancient as once believed. Recent findings generated by the Hubble Space Telescope have scaled down the age of the universe to only 12 to 13.4 billion years. While these numbers are still incomprehensible in terms of life on Earth, they pale in comparison to original estimates of 20 billion years old. Furthermore, the slow expansion of the universe is accelerating, leading researchers to believe that the end of the universe will be with a whimper, not a bang, or an implosion, as previously believed. You're listening to Talking History. Dreamland has been described as a fascinating and compelling novel. So why talk about it on Talking History? Because it's classified as an historical novel, a type of literature we've not yet considered on this show, but that is one of our most popular and influential sources of historical information. It's time to take a look at this important genre. So we've invited to join us today the author of the novel Dreamland, Kevin Baker. Baker's the author of an earlier novel, Sometimes You See It Coming, loosely based on the life of baseball great Ty Cobb, and he was the chief historical researcher for the American Century, recently published by Harold Evans. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. Congratulations on the success of your latest book.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been a wonderful experience.
I bet it has. Bring us up to speed a bit to give us a very brief summary of what the novel is about.
Well, Dreamland is sort of a three-ring circus set out in Coney Island, which was then the site of these amazing amusement parks, and where kind of all of New York comes, from gangsters to garment workers in the Lower East Side to corrupt cops and politicians engaged in one of the most notorious murders in the city's history, to even Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung on their first visit to America.
Coney Island, fascinating place, but why Coney Island? Why New York City? Why 1911 for your novel?
Well, it's part of a great crossroads of America at the time, of the world at the time. It's a great turning point in America and the American century when all these people from all over the world come here, and which so much of our modern world stems from. And Coney Island was kind of the place. It was sort of the place where they projected all their fears and hopes about the new world they were making, the new world they were living in.
You've got two or three storylines or plots. Can you just tell us maybe about a couple of them so you can give the reader, our listeners a sense of what they'll be reading?
Sure. It involves this real-life murder in New York, a murder of a gambler named Beansy Rosenthal, which was created tremendous turmoil in the city. It involved the gangsters who were out to kill him on the supposedly on the orders of a corrupt cop. And it involves a young woman named Esther who works in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory and other sweatshops on the Lower East Side of New York, and who gets sort of involved in this. She's out kind of trying to see what she has to offer the world, what the world has to offer her, and as a result comes to Coney and gets involved in kind of this continual brouhaha that's going on out there.
What's the title Dreamland mean?
Dreamland was one of the three major parks there. It was Luna Park, Steeplechase, and Dreamland. And these were these, and it's also, of course, refers to how people saw the United States, you know, that they were coming to from all over the world. And it refers, of course, to Freud and the new medical science of psychology that he was bringing into being at the time. And the parks were just exquisite places. They were just kind of much more beautiful and strange and also kind of grotesque and bizarre than what we think of as an amusement park today.
So it has a triple layer of meaning here for that particular word.
Right, right.
What makes Dreamland historical fiction? I guess by asking that, I'm really asking you, what do you mean or how would you define historical fiction?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I sometimes wonder if the term has any validity at all. I mean, since after all fiction is telling stories, and if the history of what happened yesterday or if it's history that happened 100 years ago, in a way, what's the difference? I mean, I think it reflects something of the unease Americans have with the past. We're a very forward-looking country, for both better and worse, and we tend to think of things that happened 50, 100 years ago as the far, far distant past. You know, when you look at something like what's going on now in Yugoslavia, that can be a distinct advantage, but it's also kind of too bad that we've lost so much of our roots, of so much of where we come from. And so what I'm trying to do in Dreamland, in part, is to bring that back, to make this a real story, not something that just happened to very different people. I think one of the chief challenges in writing historical fiction is that you always have to keep in mind that customs change completely, but people really essentially don't change at all. I think it's a very hard, kind of somewhat opposed idea to keep in mind at the same time.
You say you're trying to tell a real story, a bit of history here, but yet you introduce at least parts of figures, if not entire characters, who are fictional.
Right.
So what advantage does this give you as an author?
Well, I think it does bring the story closer to people. I mean, I think there is the advantage of getting kind of the everyman character in there. I mean, the real historical figures are fascinating, and I tried to hew as closely as possible to what they actually believed in and did. I mean, wonderful characters such as Freud, such as Big Tim Sullivan, a wonderful politico of the time, a real-life figure from Tammany Hall, who was kind of a combination of, if you can picture it, of, say, John Gotti, Rudy Giuliani, Michael Eisner, and Donald Trump. You know, he was a man who was ran street gangs, was a politico, was a real estate magnate, was a magnate in an emerging entertainment industry, such as movie theaters and Coney Island itself. But you also want to go beyond kind of just the historical figures and get to what everyday life was like. And I think that can, like, really give a tremendous insight into how we lived as Americans at that point. So Esther, the main heroine of the novel, made-up figure, lives in a Lower East Side tenement like so many young women did at the time, sleeps on a couple of chairs pulled up in a kitchen. Her parents have one room there. The three different boarders who share another room. And goes out and works 10 to 15 hours a day in these sweatshops, but is also trying to build sort of a better life for herself and her family. And I think that's one of these stories that can kind of slip in and out between the official narrative. That's what I was trying to get at.
Okay. Well, now you mentioned Freud, and there are other figures certainly that we could put into one group that any reader is going to immediately recognize as at least perhaps an historical figure. They may not trust exactly what you're writing. When you bring Freud into the novel, can they trust that Freud is being brought in historically here? That
is accurate. I stuck very closely to the real accounts of Freud and Jung's visit, and it was a fascinating visit because this is kind of where the split between the two men really starts to come into its own. It wasn't fully realized till a little while later. And while I've made up some things, such as an encounter Freud has with a minister at the time, almost all of the accounts are quite true. Freud had a terrible time in America. He said it was a gigantic mistake. He was fainting. He became incontinent at one point. All of this is quite true. And I think it has less to do in true Freudian fashion with America and more to do with Jung. But I do explore that as closely as possible to the historical record.
Interesting. Okay, now you say that Esther is made up, but what about some of your other, I think, wonderful characters, Grabber, Spanish Louis, Jip the Blood? Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, thanks. I mean, the Gangland character, you know, I think Gangland gives one a certain leeway. I mean, I think you do have an obligation to the truth as much as it's known of it in historical fiction. But, of course, in Gangland, you have a great leeway because so much of it is is based on rumor and innuendo anyway. And these characters were tremendously colorful. There was Jip the Blood, who was a real-life character, very nasty individual who actually used to break men's back on a $2 bet. This Kid Twist, another gangster of the period. The Spanish Louis, a gangster who actually used to walk around with a huge sombrero and these kind of crossed bandoleros and implied that he was some kind of Mexican outlaw. And this is all on the Lower East Side of New York. And after his death, it turned out he was the son of a Jewish man who lived in Brooklyn. The Grabber was another real-life character who I just saw references to as that, the Grabber. I didn't look too closely into who he really was because it has such a great name, almost seems like death itself, and is represented there. Then there are some characters who are semi-made up, such as Trick the Dwarf, who's mayor of an all-dwarf and midget city out on Coney Island. Trick himself is made up, but, for instance, the city actually existed and had a mayor. It was a year-round, 400-person city, had its own police department and fire department, and at the same time was a circus exhibit. And that's one thing you find, too, about the past, and particularly the American past. You can't make this stuff up. You know, you can't outdo some of the color of our actual past.
Well, the interesting part is I read through it. Most of these people, at first glance, I thought I would not want to meet them. I'd rather read about them. But after you get about halfway through the novel, it sort of turns around and you wish you could actually see them somehow on the streets. Maybe not too closely, right, but still see them nonetheless.
Well thanks. Yeah, I it's a time, like so many times in the past, that I think it would be tremendous fun to visit. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to live there. I can imagine kind of going around in a New York summer dressed all in woolen clothing without any air conditioning. At the same point, it would be great fun to kind of just go back and see what it looked like with, say, entire apartment houses sleeping out on the roof to get away from the heat or the fire escapes. It'd be great fun to see these kind of phantasmagorical amusement parks. It'd be fun to meet people like Big Tim Sullivan or be in a Tammany meeting. But I really wouldn't want them running my city now.
I hear you. Now, it seems to me that we're not just dealing with historical figures here, but we're also talking about historical situations. You mentioned one earlier, the Triangle Factory fire.
Right.
So you are actually placing even your fictional characters into historical situations.
Yes. That and the murder of Beansy are real events. The Triangle fire was the second worst disaster in New York City history. 146 people, mostly women and girls, ages 13 to 23, died in this horrendous industrial fire that turned out to be a real seminal moment in reform of working conditions in the labor movement in the United States. And it was, just a horrendous tragedy, but it also brings into greater relief the terrific effort of these, and this is one of the great parts of the immigrant experience, of these young women. Most of them Jewish, known as the Febrente Madlock, the fiery girls, who, even despite how young they were, went and organized the ILGWU, one of the great labor unions in our history, just kind of through their fiery speeches in the street corners and through their organizing, even though these were kind of penniless, you know, originally powerless women, they really just built this up and changed our society much for the better. And it's just a great story that I really wanted to get in.
Now, I had heard of, and I think perhaps many of our listeners have heard of the Triangle Factory fire, but the Herman Beansy Rosenthal murder has gotten by me in my reading of history, and yet it seems terribly important in your novel. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it actually, it was another part in kind of the decline of Tammany Hall. It led to, you know, a huge outcry at the time. It was a gangster who was killed supposedly at the orders of a police lieutenant who he complained of as shaking him down. And the intricacies of it are actually very interesting, but I won't spoil it for the reader. It's the same murder actually that's mentioned in The Great Gatsby by the character Meyer Wolfsheim, who talks about it. But it was really like a huge controversy at the time, and it kind of exposed the fact that the police department at the time in New York worked in good part as the collection agency for Tammany Hall and its kind of regular shakedowns of everybody, store owners, gamblers, houses of prostitution, all went into this machine, which did something for the people, for the new immigrants. They were the only people doing something for them, but which was also terribly self-interested and kind of prevented any kind of further change from being made.
Just have a couple minutes left, so let me bring you back to a more basic question here. Your reviewers have described the novel as a meticulous or a blend of meticulous historical research and assured narrative invention. Do we need to know, I guess we're asking a larger question here about historical fiction, but do we need to know where one ends and where the other begins, the line between what is historical and what is fiction in your novel?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think there are certain obligations a novelist has, you know, for instance, I would never have Freud espousing, you know, Jung's theories. I would never have Tammany figures acting in ways completely different from how they did act. In fact, you know, in terms of the guilt of the people involved in the murder, in researching it, I found that the person largely thought to have been responsible probably wasn't. So I felt obligated to, you know, to spell that out. At the same time, I think when you put a great big label on something, fiction, a novel, you know, just right in the cover, I think you do have a certain leeway. I think you have a chance to tell it as a tale. I would just hope that even fiction could play a part in our society, you know, forming us what we are today. For instance, ancient Greeks didn't think of the Iliad as, say, historical fiction. They thought of it as an essential part, like a founding myth of their society. And you could, you know, take that founding myth and research it and find, you know, the real history behind it, you know, the exact facts, or you could make up your own mythologies around it. But I would just want it to be part of our America today.
We've only got 30 seconds, very quickly. Who was responsible for putting a novel on the title page?
Oh, my publisher, HarperCollins. But I totally agree with it. And in the back, I have a kind of a section on what was true and what was not, so the reader can judge for themselves.
Okay. And we'll end it there. Thank you, Kevin, for joining us. And again, congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much.
It's a very good read.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Kevin Baker, author of Dreamland, a historical novel published by HarperCollins. And this is Talking History. Last year, a long-standing controversy in American history was moved one step toward resolution when DNA tests showed that the descendants of Easton Hemings, son of Sally Hemings, one of Thomas Jefferson's slaves, was quite likely the product of a liaison between Sally and Thomas Jefferson, or at least someone in the Jefferson family. The matter's not quite resolved, but it has certainly given Jefferson's white descendants pause. Here to provide his perspective on this latest information is one of those descendants, Lucian Truscott IV, a fifth-generation grandson of Thomas Jefferson.
The descendants of Thomas Jefferson, who belong to the Monticello Association, of which I am one, find ourselves facing a crucial decision in the coming year, whether or not to include the descendants of Sally Hemings into the family organization. Sally's descendants have for over 200 years held that they are also great-grandchildren of Mr. Jefferson, who they say fathered Sally's children. Challenged to prove this, they have given their blood for DNA analysis, and lo and behold, some of the findings came up positive. And so the Monticello Association, as well as all of our fellow citizens who are descended as Americans from Mr. Jefferson as a founding father of the nation, must confront this question. What does DNA tell us about Mr. Jefferson and ourselves? I mean, what separates me and my brother Frank and our sisters and our mother and father or our grandparents from any of Sally Hemings' descendants? Or for that matter, from the descendants of any of the 82 slaves who were owned by Mr. Jefferson on the day when he wrote these words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Is it really DNA? Is it that if you have this genetic marker, you're lucky, but if you have that one, you're not? Is that what separates us? No. Prejudice separates us and always has. This story isn't about DNA, and it's not about luck. It's about slavery and the rank prejudice which has contaminated our land with a racial fallout that has had a very long and dispiriting half-life. Many of Jefferson's descendants have sought to cling to a rather peculiar vision of him. While hobbled by Mr. Jefferson's conflicted ideas about slavery, their version of him has held on to the fiction that he was unlike other men who owned plantations and slaves, unlike even Mr. Jefferson's wife Martha's father, who had fathered Sally Hemings, making Sally the half-sister of Martha. Now, to the horror of the historians and Jefferson worshipers and many in the Monticello Association, DNA has reached around and bitten them. That we've had to finally confront the truth about Mr. Jefferson in a test tube is the most dispiriting thing of all, for deep inside, I think most of us have known the truth all along. What are we to take away from all of this? Frank and I were taught, and so were our sisters, and so have we taught our children, that we were not better than the kids around us simply because we were lucky enough to have white skin. That's what Mr. Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that if we're all equal, then luck has nothing to do with it. While he failed to do the right thing, to carry out this marvelous ideal in his own life, we have learned much from Mr. Jefferson, and we have much to thank him for. But in the end, his most profound teaching may turn out to have been that by his actions, we have learned he was just a man. We should open our arms and our hearts to the descendants of the children this man had with Sally Hemings. We should welcome them into the Monticello Association as our cousins and into their rightful place as part of the history of these United States.
You've been listening to Lucian Truscott IV, a fifth-generation grandson of Thomas Jefferson. This is Talking History. Wonderful, warm days of summer pass, we continue to call to your attention the nation's many fine historic sites that would also be great vacation destinations. This week we highlight a lovely historic village in Vermont, and here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Bennington is Vermont's first chartered town, and this year it's celebrating its 250th anniversary. Major improvements are underway in Bennington. The museum has added a 6,000 square foot wing. The old First Church has been renovated, a community park is in the works, and even some of the old mills have been retooled to accommodate new businesses. The rich history of colonial Vermont and the Revolutionary War have been preserved in all of this, and you will find plenty of 18th and 19th century clapboard houses and churches. The Bennington Battle Monument still characterizes the old Bennington, the site of the first settlement. And just outside of town, covered bridges span a multitude of springs.
Thank you, Cindy. Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, If you're planning on being in New York City before October 11th, you might find interesting an exhibit on the ill-fated Ernest Shackleton expedition, a failed attempt to cross Antarctica in 1915. One day shy of reaching the continent, the group's ship, Endurance, became trapped in ice, and Shackleton set out on a harrowing 800-mile lifeboat voyage to save his crew. The exhibit is at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And in the nation's capital, at the National Museum of American History, you can see a new exhibit, A Collector's Vision of Puerto Rico. This exhibit, which closes in February 2000, includes religious images, carnival masks and costumes, musical instruments, colonial art, and jewelry from the past 500 years of Puerto Rican history and culture. Be sure to call ahead to both museums for further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when we will take a look at the business of Daimler-Benz during the Third Reich. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.